Welcome to Love Letters to Planet Earth. I'm your host, Tessa Antola. This is a podcast for anyone who is worried about the state of our planet and wants to connect with others around our shared fears, anxiety, and grief. How do we learn to restore our kinship with nature, foster emotional resiliency, and find joy in this moment of planetary change? This is a space for us to practice how to learn, unravel, and rebuild together. Thank you so much for joining me here. Today, we'll be speaking with Leslie Davenport, a planetary psychotherapist. She'll help us set the stage for the impacts that climate change is having on our emotions. We'll focus today on getting a handle of what happens in our brains and how we get so stuck and how to get unstuck and then do this over and over again because this work is so cyclical. As we go along in this podcast, we'll be delving into how our emotional health is connected to our planet's health. Leslie is here with us today to explore why many of us humans are still really stuck in the paralysis of climate change. We're struggling to start the revitalizing work of repairing our relationship with nature in a more meaningful way. But things like denial, fear, shame, isolation, powerlessness, you know, and many more can really get us stuck. So here we are to work together to get past what gets sticky so we can move into the action. You talk about this in your book, Leslie, Emotional Resiliency in the Era of Climate Change, and you do a lot of work in the world around this. You've told me you're also really inspired by your grandchildren, and you also have a children's book coming out soon on how to help kids feel their way through the anxiety around climate change. Leslie, I'd just really love you to tell us more about the work you do in the world. I'd really love to hear about your personal relationship with nature and how it really brought you to be, a climate therapist and what exactly that means.
Oh, lots of big questions there.
I know. Let's just jump in.
Okay. Well, first, I just want to thank you for inviting me into this conversation. I'm really appreciating the levels in which we're entering into this because, you know, when it does come to climate change, yes, it's about the environment, it's about fossil fuels, it's about systems and structures, but it's about our hearts and our minds and discovering what it means to be human and going deeper in that and responding in new and creative ways. And maybe, you know, just in saying that, it's part of what draws me to this work. I really find that it requires every part of me to be involved, to look again, to understand more fully, to question beliefs that may have formed through my life that are, like for all of us, up for review.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. And so I have to say that my work in this field of climate psychology is just going in a million directions at once, and it may narrow, but I'll just try and give you the highlights. So yeah, you mentioned my two books related to this. And because of especially the first book, Emotional Resiliency in the Era of Climate Change, I wrote that for the mental health field. So that has led me to creating some workshops to train therapists more on how to respond and what does it mean to build new competencies when people do come in with eco grief or eco anxiety. And I'm excited to say that I learned just last week, there's a university in California called California Institute of Integral Studies. And with another psychologist, Barb Easterlin, we're going to co-design a 75-hour certificate program. And really have a chance to go in depth. And it's, again, primarily geared toward professionals in the field who really want to add this awareness to their work. So there's all of that. And then
that's so exciting.
Thank you. The other thing really interesting to me is there's a lot of nonprofits, advocacy organizations, people who are doing environmental work and have been doing it for quite a while, who are starting to approach me and others doing similar work and saying, you know, we've got a lot of this advocacy stuff down, but we're really beginning to recognize the importance of the psychological dimensions and how to bring more of us to the work and how to stay in it for the long run. And there's a real opening happening there that's very exciting. So there's a big piece of work that's starting to evolve in that direction too.
That is so exciting. You know, I was recently reading something, and I don't remember where it was, but it was talking about even as subtle as like the intake process when you go to see a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, still to this day, most therapists don't really address climate change.
Yeah.
And so just those little subtle ways we as therapists could be bringing in more of that language and that narrative and just making more space. You know, maybe someone is feeling a lot of climate anxiety and doesn't really know how to put their finger on it.
Yes. And honestly, while it's changing, I even think some clients who are in touch with their climate anxiety don't even necessarily think that therapy is the place to work on it, strange as that may sound.
Oh, but that's a good point. I can see that, though. Yeah.
You know, we go there to talk about work stuff or relationship issues or to figure out how our childhood is affecting us now. And, you know, you're right. It's not very much in the mind frame of many therapists or clients that this is a really good place to open all that up.
You know, I have a little example, and it actually is inspired by this piece I read in your book about the importance of connection around climate change. And it's that little story you told about, so this person goes to see this therapist because they have this social speaking anxiety, but they're about to speak on some really innovative sciences around climate change. So the therapist, you just set this really cool stage that I guess I hadn't thought about before. It seems so basic, but I think what you just spoke to gets to that. So anyway, you go through this story about how the therapist helped this person. This person went and did this speech. This speech touched these people's hearts. All of this technology changed. These relationships were built. And then you ended this story with the partner of the person that spoke and the loving lunch they made for them.
And, yes.
And I think in a roundabout way, that's sort of what you're talking about, is there's so much pressure to relate around climate change in this very sort of specific and singular way around, mm-hmm. you better go out and, you know, recycle or change legislation in your town or city or do these really big, broad things, but there's so many more opportunities for us to impact the world and each other that we don't quite have the language or the experience for.
Yes, and you know, you're speaking really to a dilemma I hear coming up when people are aware of climate change and want to make a difference, and they'll say, but you know, I'm not an engineer, or I'm not a climate scientist, or I'm just not that comfortable out in the streets. And, you know, if we look at the fact that every human endeavor, from farming to teaching to healthcare to therapists, artists, you know, absolutely every part of what we do and who we are can be reoriented through a sustainability lens. And and also too, you know, like you're saying, it's hard to measure the benefits of our contributions. You know, I've struggled with that. You know, am I doing enough when I'm sitting one-on-one in a room working on therapy? But the story that you're telling is just how much it ripples out because of those connections and because we need absolutely the full range of talents and interests and capabilities, and everything counts and everyone counts.
You know, if I could jump ahead a little bit, I know we had touched on genetic determination versus cultural determination, and mm-hmm. what exactly that means. I think this is a really great moment to maybe sort of emphasize the power of that and kind of be intentional about how we bring that work into the world.
Okay. So the way that typically gets talked about is that we are on the edge of a really significant shift when it comes to humanity at large and the movement of the world as a whole. And that when it comes to evolution, we've thought of it in genetic terms and yes. just the things we understand about that and evolution. But that because of how things are now and are the human influence on the biosphere and on the mm-hmm. land and on animals and the impacts that are there, it's shifting to what's being called a cultural determination, meaning that the decisions that we make and the priorities that we put into play are going to affect the lives and direction and what the mm-hmm. earth and all of its inhabitants are going to look like and be like. In other yeah. words, you know, it's easy to think of it in concrete terms. Most people are aware of how the melting ice sheets, for example, are affecting the lives of the polar bears.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Yep. And there's, you know, many, many examples of things like that. So it's how we intervene and what we choose to do that's just going to have a direct outcome in how mm-hmm. all of that is shaped.
Well, and you know, when I first start, like, I had, I guess, imagined or like intuitively gotten this shift in ways, but reading, it's funny because when I read about this in your book, I started noticing this language in other places. Mm. But what was both, like, at first I think I was really scared of that, like, oh, wow, that is kind of terrifying where we could go. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, sort of along the lines of what we're talking about right now is how do we understand that this can also go in a really positive and beautiful way?
Yes. Yes. There's the unknown and our responsibility in facing and shaping this unknown is a creative opportunity. You know, there's certain things that are set in motion and certain features we yeah. need to work with, but we could look at it like the painter looking at a blank canvas or yeah. the dancer in an empty room before any movement is manifest.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's this way that we can dig deep into our well of creativity and apply that toward not just stabilizing the climate, not just going back to what we had before, mm-hmm. but how might it even be more beautiful, more healthy? I think we need to yeah. really open up our visioning capacities with where we are right now.
Yeah, yeah. That really seems like that's the work.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
Oh, well, it's so much fun talking to you about this. you know, I want to talk about sort of one of the main reasons that you're here today, which is your understanding on really what gets in our way towards, in our way in terms of moving towards more healing.
Yes.
From a human perspective, like in our human brain. Can you say... Mm-hmm. some more about that?
Yes. You know, unfortunately, the way our brains have evolved don't serve us very well when it comes to some of the challenges of climate change. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So, we are really programmed to deal with the immediate, what's immediately in front of us. What threats are there that we have to deal with? What challenges are here in the moment now? And to take in and consider something with such a long arc of climate change, kind of what its origins are and the trajectory that the scientists are describing, it has been easy, although it's getting harder, for people mentally to put it off as this is something happening someplace else, some other time, some other place, because I have a lot to deal with right now in my life.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's really potent is that it's very difficult for us to inhabit this unknown space we've been describing, especially if it has threats and risks associated with it.
Yeah.
It's easy to feel a sense of overwhelm, and it can be very hard to tolerate that. So we unconsciously find ways to give ourselves relief, like turning away. Someone else is going to solve this. This is going to be figured out. Or this might sound paradoxical, but going to a place of doom, it's too late. There's nothing we can do.
Yes. Oh, so many people do that, don't they?
It's really happening more and more. And it's not to say what's true or what's not true according to science, but it's saying that it lets us off the hook. There's a kind of relief in saying, all right, if that's the deal, then there's really nothing I need to do.
Yeah.
And because this is baked into our evolution, you know, I really try and help people see it, understand it, and bring a lot of compassion to ourselves and to others, that these are many of the challenges that we need to deal with on the mental, emotional levels.
Yeah. Well, and one of the big ones is grief, right? And although it is hardwired into our brains to grieve, and the cycle of grief and joy is, you know, really compared to composting a garden, you need it to stay fresh, to stay ready to grow. We don't necessarily preach that truth in our culture. Often people, you know, you fit grief into these little 2-week windows after you've lost a relationship or someone you love or something hard has happened, but we really don't know how to see grief as this really positive, malleable making process.
Yes, very much so. That the full spectrum of emotions, including all those that are part of the grief process, really are our allies. You know, they're telling us things. They're part of how we metabolize our experiences. And it's when we try and hold them at bay or push them down that the problems occur. But I think you're right. A lot of people are still sort of afraid of big feelings.
Yeah.
And there's, I would agree that there's a cultural bias against making space for that.
Yes.
And even to talk about any climate change feelings, largely, again, it's shifting, but largely is still a little bit taboo. Like, oh, don't be the downer who brings this up at the family dinner.
It's almost pathologized, isn't it?
Yes. Like, oh, you're so sensitive, or oh, you're, you know, this or that. And, you know, it's a way that other people don't have to feel their feelings by pushing it off on the other person. So it's understandable, but it makes it very difficult unless we can find places to share these feelings with each other.
Well, and speaking of, that's a really important process in emotional elasticity in this moment. And moving forward is a part of grieving, which is kind of the next step of this work, right? Before we can really get those wheels turning and find that joy, that experience on the other side, we've got to feel what it's like to feel sad, to feel this loss, and to feel that in relationship with other people. Because another message we've been given as modern humans, as Americans, is you hide that away. You don't share that with other people. That's sort of a shameful or, you know, a sensitive, like you said, part of being human. And, you know, it's not meant for other eyes.
Yes, very much so. And you know, I think it's good to say even a little bit more when we say loss associated with grief. how many versions of that, how many features there are within climate change. So,
yeah.
You know, especially among the youth, there's this sense of a loss of their future, the way they anticipated looking at careers and relationships and shaping their life moving forward. I'm thinking high school, early college.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot of loss as it relates to facing government inaction and the
so much so.
There's losses, you know, of things like going to our favorite family lake, but we can't really enjoy it now because there's toxic algae blooms that have shut it down for a while.
Or it's burned down.
And the really direct, losses related to extinctions and, the major changes to the environment.
You know, I was talking to a friend of my son's recently, and we were talking about climate change and just sort of like, what are you, you know, where do you think we're going? And this kid with such like definitiveness said, you know, I think the world has about 60 years left. Humanity has 60 years left. And I just like, and said it without much emotion, honestly. And I just felt like, oh, I want to prove to you otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and not to say that there's not, that wasn't a complicated emotional moment for me where there was just grief and guilt and, you know, all of these emotions in this, but also like I wanted to prove them wrong as sort of their elder and a person that has more say in the mess we made than they do, arguably.
Yes. And, you know, those are such challenging moments because, you know, the how to respond in an appropriate, sensitive way where you're receiving them where they are.
Yes.
And also, you know, opening up possibilities or other ways of thinking or things to consider is really tricky, as you're saying.
It is. It is. Yeah. You know, speaking of the youth, you said that you're really inspired by your grandchildren, and that really gives you this sense of connection to nature. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how do you relate to nature? What's brought you to this work outside of your, you know, professional experience with it? Talk about your own personal journey.
Well, yeah, I'll say a little bit. I'll start with my grandkids because, you know, it's a relatively common experience to kind of see the world again with fresh eyes as you hear them describing their excitement about something, you know, watching a seed that gets planted and then what comes up. And I just love entering that connection and fascination and awe and love of nature is so present with these kids. They're 3 and 5.
Oh, sweet.
But I also get to be part of helping them see some of the connections that aren't very well articulated. For example, like most kids, they like to, you know, play in the bath or take showers and water play. But I'll say, you know, okay, we're going to have to turn it off in just a moment because this is the water that we're sharing with the plants and animals outside.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Because, you know, there's this, you know, modern magic. You turn a faucet, water comes out, you turn off a faucet, and there's no sense of it, how it ties into the rivers and the rain and the oceans until it's learned in kind of a cognitive way.
But many grow up not learning this.
That's right. And so to introduce that in a way where they're already wanting to take care of the plants and animals outside because they love it so much.
Yeah.
And connecting it to how we're living, even in some of the most basic ways, just gives me a lot of joy.
Oh, that is joyful. Tell me why it gives you joy, Leslie.
Boy, hard to talk about. One thing I would say is, you know, I'm aware of these different ways or lenses of knowing or experiencing a moment. So when I'm really in my head, and I also love reading and academics and figuring things out, I do a lot of that. It's a certain kind of enjoyment. But when that is quieted and what's emerging instead is this very direct, visceral engagement with the moment and the environment where there's just this undeniable aliveness that's flowing through us and where we are and how we're connected. That for me just seems to be such a fertile breeding ground of joy.
No kidding. I mean, I feel you. I mean, I feel like that's a part of that stuff. You know, we've talked about the grief and not as much about, and I know I'm oversimplifying the process of grieving. There's a lot of other emotional components to it, but being able to see sort of where we've gotten lost from nature, mm-hmm. and what it's like to be a byproduct of this, you know, a very general way to say it is sort of this patriarchal mm-hmm. numbing experience where you don't really feel your body, for one, and you're not able to feel your nature attached to your body, for two, and just the layers of disconnection that have been happening for, you know, at this point, hundreds of years. I mean, some argue longer.
Yes.
In our evolutionary process, but being able to get so far from that and start that path back mm-hmm. is deeply satisfying. I mean, there is mm-hmm. a joy to it, even in the midst of the incredibly complicated grief of this moment that we're in with nature, to be able to have such a simple, lovely little lesson. It's sort of the, like, it's bittersweet, and the sweetness to it is being able to give your grandchildren what you didn't get, and maybe what you weren't even sure of how to give your own children at the time. Mm-hmm. But the, like, coming home to this part of us that is built into our planetary DNA.
Yes.
As a part of nature.
Beautifully said. Yes. And I really want to underscore, as a part of nature. You know, I think even at our language chops things up in inaccurate ways. You know, we talk about going to nature, enjoying nature, maybe being afraid of nature, whatever it is.
As this very separated thing.
As if it was separate from who we are.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I honestly feel like shifting that in a very visceral way is a big part of the healing journey we're on.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of a quote I have here in front of me from Robin Wall Kimmerer from her book Braiding Sweetgrass. Mm-hmm. It says, "Knowing that you love the earth changes you, activates you to defend and protect and celebrate. But when you feel that the earth loves you in return, that feeling transforms the relationship from a one-way street into a sacred bond."
Oh, beautiful.
Isn't it?
Beautiful.
So I think that's what's really bringing the two of us together on this first episode of Love Letters to Planet Earth, is really starting to, like, awkwardly, clumsily, tenderly begin to open back up that door that has felt very closed and distant because of how we're socialized in our culture, to just, like, sort of stepping our feet out this door into this, our bare feet, by the way, out of this door onto this, like, grassy little place that we don't really know what to do with at this point, but being really open to try to learn.
Yes, I love that. And to just add that, as you've already stated, it's natural within us. It's part of our DNA. And so, yes, there are tools and practices and specific things, but a lot can be gained just by a curiosity, a willingness, an exploration, just going to see what you notice, to open to these questions, to open to the environment, and
yeah,
and that there, you know, we don't need a textbook for that.
No, we don't. Well, and maybe it's in some of our toolkit, because that can be nice.
But yeah.
I was just talking to someone earlier today about this, and they were saying it's such a magical and sort of intuitive bond that once we start to try to give it language, and not that that's a bad thing, that's one way we connect as humans is through our language.
Yes.
But even like the moment you start to give it language, it sort of loses some of the mystery, which, you know, that's okay to an extent. So language just can't be the only way we get there.
Yes. Yes.
You know, you also talk about connections and sort of this concept of co-regulation around our planetary anxiety and, you know, related to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to talk a little bit more about that. But as we're sort of doing that with each other right now, right?
Yes, like we are.
Sharing our joys, sharing our fears, our anxieties. But there's something really special that happens between human beings when they sort of, you know, get their worst fears out, get their biggest hopes out. Like it starts to sort of grow this new life between us.
Yes, very much so. I've become interested in a theory in psychology called polyvagal theory.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things it describes is, in terms of this connection you're talking about, is that our very nervous systems start to regulate each other. Mm-hmm. That it's the ideas that we're sort of emotionally contagious. And we can use that in a beneficial way, so that anything we do as individuals that are helping us to get grounded or feel those visceral connections we're describing, as we engage with others, as we move through the world, it's influential because of how we how we affect each other in this co-regulation process.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we were just talking in terms of cultural determination, like that can go either way, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of people feel so doom-filled, because mm-hmm. what you hear in the larger sort of media, government, in some of these larger cultural places is not a lot of that contagious, intoxifying hope.
Yes.
You know, you hear about the polar bears and the ice caps melting, and you think, God, I have no idea what to do about that, and that feels so terrifying. I'm just going to shut that down and go away.
Yes. Well, this makes me want to briefly mention another thing that our brain does.
Let's do it.
So there's a cognitive bias that we all have, and again, it has to do with our evolution, called the negativity bias. And what this means is that our brains, and therefore our nervous systems and emotions, tend to register threats or distress 3 to 5 times more strongly than they do with a neutral or positive experience. And it's part of our survival. Like, how do we stay safe? We need to kind of scan the environment for risks and threats. And this happens, of course, with news and everything else. And it's not in any way to diminish the severity of what we're facing.
Yes, yes.
But to know that it's being amplified in our brain and in our experience.
Yes. Already.
which is why we have to be a little more active to seek out, well, where are changes happening and what good people are out there, you know, doing such wonderful work, and where are reasonable and even scientifically backed places of hope?
Yes, yes. I think that is more important than we realize. I mean, I think what I got from your book too is the connection and the capacity to co-regulate towards planetary health is really key in this work.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, maybe another way of saying that is, you know, we really can't separate our internal work and our external work. You know,
absolutely.
There's the advocacy forms we're talking about, which I'm calling the external, and then there's how we are in relation to ourselves and our environment and each other.
Yes.
That is the internal work. And even that's probably a false division just for the sake of words, but to recognize it is in the whole that healing is possible.
And as we are essentially walking configurations of soil and plant and animal material and stardust, you know, a part of where this podcast is gonna sort of tenderly explore is how we can even add another dimension of how we are attached in this inextricable way to nature. You know, taking this concept of co-regulation, how do we co-regulate with nature?
Right. And you know, I think of, you know, exploring the answers to that, not just in a mental way, are tied to what we were saying of notice what happens when you're walking by a tree or pausing in a meadow or feeling the sun, whatever it might be. That's where the knowledge is already written that
absolutely
you're describing.
And you know, how can we start to return that towards nature, that care?
Yes.
Like how our emotional health, our overall health is linked to the planet's health, and coming back to sort of that cultural determination, that co-regulation, how can we now take that in an even more intentional and intimate way and start to care for nature?
Yes. As I'm hearing you say that, I'm having this image arise of, you know, it's like a circle. It's not even reciprocity, like one direction, other direction, back and forth.
Yeah.
But that there's this sort of continual flow that we can attend to in a conscious way as these parts of us awaken.
Yes, yes. And I think attached to that, start to really value even like making a loving lunch for your partner who's going to be speaking at this event, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You know, this year we were experiencing some really terrible air quality because some fires up in northern Minnesota. And I became sort of frantic, like a mother who couldn't console her baby with my bees outside. And I started researching how to leave them water, how to make little hiding spots for them. And, you know, arguably one could say, well, what is that really doing for the climate? Or is that really going to change anything? And, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I would have felt like that was silly or too vulnerable, or like maybe someone would see that and make a judgment about my behavior.
Uh-huh.
But I don't see it like that anymore. In fact, I think being able to really just be curious and playful and childlike, right? Like your children playing in water, but also learning like they have a responsibility to water and to nature around that.
Yes.
Just letting ourselves get a little more whimsical and open to what that relationship could look like.
Very much. Beautifully said. And, you know, there may very well still be those people who thinks it's silly that you did that, but that does not have to be influential on.
No, I don't care about it that much anymore. And maybe I feel a bit of sadness for them that they're still in that really detached place.
Yes. Yes.
Because it's really lonely to be there.
Yes. You know, I like to think of what you're describing too as, you know, kind of like jiggle a thread or pull a thread anywhere and it affects everything else, you know, large and small.
Yes. Well, it reminds me of how you introduced yourself today. You're like, you know, my work has sort of brought me in all sorts of directions. And it kind of made me think about, it's not just like this very simple, clean work. It's sort of like letting ourselves be tugged and pulled and curious mm-hmm. and playful and try different things out. I mean, I'm sure it took you some time to kind of get to a place where you were like, ah, this is how I do this work, or this is what makes me feel really joyful, or here's where I feel like my resources can be used really effectively. Like we can't just find that without getting to explore a little bit.
Yes, and I like to pay a lot of attention to not only what arises within me that I might want to test out or offer, but really noticing what, I like to say, what shows up at my gate. Hmm. You know,
that's a good way to look at it, yeah.
And that it's kind of like this dance. Honestly, the book for kids you're describing happened that way. The publisher, which is with the American Psychological Association Children's Book Division, reached out to me on Twitter and said, would you write this book? And it's not particularly where I had been focusing my work, but I kind of took it in, the request, and sat with it. And it, you know, I heard a yes coming up. So it's not something I would have particularly designed right then, but it emerged through this kind of co-creation process.
That's beautiful, and I can really connect with that. I never really saw myself as someone who would start a podcast.
Yeah.
Yet it just, like, the pieces just sort of laid themselves out, and I took that next step, and it really came together in this way that, you know, I've tried a lot of different things environmentally, and I've always known I wanted to do more around my background in trauma therapy environmentally. And, you know, I've enjoyed some things, I've not enjoyed some things. And it's just about being willing and curious to try some new things out until you get to a place where you feel like you really find your groove.
Yes. Well, I, for one, am very glad you got tapped on the shoulder about this podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be talking to you today. I really just feel your excitement and your openness to this work. And it gives me a lot of joy to see that.
Thank you. It's mutual.
Thank you, Leslie. Leslie, you know, before we end today, I want to hear a little bit about what gets you stuck in your process of getting past it. I think a lot of listeners, me included, really want to understand how people who are doing really great work and have been doing it for a while, you know, the idea of buoyancy isn't about you never get stuck, right? It's about being able to move past it when you do. Could you take a little time and talk to us about how you get past the sticky places or the hopeless moments or the grief when it strikes you so hard?
Yes. Couple things come up as you ask that question. One is, I have become much more comfortable in just letting the tears flow when something prompts them. It'll sometimes happen when I'm reading a new news story, or I've just been working at something for a long time and I'm sort of depleted and didn't quite recognize it.
Yeah.
And I find that if I allow myself to, I don't know, I'm thinking of it right now, of sort of just flow in that river of grief, right? In the river of grief.
Yes.
That it's kind of cleansing in a way. You know,
it sure is, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels cleansing and healthy, and that I'm kind of renewed to keep going.
Yeah.
Two other things come to mind. I do find it very helpful to speak with others, even in our conversation today, which has roamed around on a lot of related ground.
Yeah.
Just feels like it adds a quality of buoyancy that I'm feeling as our conversation evolves.
Like you're not having to hold all this up by yourself.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Leslie, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate the insight and the experience you bring, and I hope to talk to you again.
And thank you so much. I completely enjoyed it.
Today, on our first episode of Love Letters to Planet Earth, I spoke with Leslie Davenport, a planetary psychotherapist. We discussed how modern humans have been taught to hide much of our grief away. The truth is, though, even when experiencing our most painful moments, the point of life is not to be numb. It's to be affected. It is good for us. It is good for the earth, and it is good for all of the mysteries, the magic, and the science that connects humans and nature. Many of you have endured much grief and trauma and feel overwhelmed by the world. Life has always been hard in ways, but now we're also missing the sense of belonging in our era of loneliness. So we know what our work is. Let's brace ourselves, sturdy our feet, and hear our ancestors calling to us through primordial magic that is belonging. We can heal if we hold on to each other. The theme of our talk today with Leslie was connection. Notice what you're feeling when you connect with a human, with the air, the water, all the things that keep us tied to this earth, to life. Emulate these experiences that make you feel calm, understood, and engaged in this moment. For some, this might look like rest. For others, this might look like action. There is value in every aspect of kindness and care that humans and nature show each other. Planetary healing is not just about eradicating the causes of climate change and reducing our carbon footprint, although important. Planetary healing is about changing our faulty old belief system, the belief in the story of separation and the ways we have tried to compete and control other life to benefit our own. These beliefs are powerful and they are embedded in every part of us, but beliefs can change, and we've just forgotten how to see that everything is a part of each other. We are all nature, and as long as we are alive, let's learn to belong again in this big, beautiful ecosystem called Earth. Did listening today bring up a desire to belong? Do you have ideas on how to do this work and ways you already are in the world? Or ways you feel really stuck? How do you connect in this planetary moment with the life around you? I would love to hear from you. Send a voice note or write me an email at loveletters2planetearth@gmail.com. This address has the number 2 for 2. If you would like to donate to support this podcast and practice, please donate today on my website at www.loveletters2planetearth.com. This address has the word 2, T-O. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next time on Love Letters to Planet Earth.